Welcome to Thought Crime. I am your host, Wesley Fox, editor and Imperial Sky Marshal of Prescient Sci-Fi. Will we ever fight wars with robots? I don't mean drones or those cute little rovers they send in to defuse bombs. What I mean are mechs, walking war machines. Yes, this episode is going to be a total just nerd episode, kind of a world-building thing on what it would be like if we're ever going to fight with mechs. And fighting robots have been a staple of science fiction for some time. You've had Transformers, Battletech, Terminator, Gundam, Evangelion, Knights of Sidonia, Voltron, Pacific Rim, Real Steel, Mechagodzilla, Falling Skies, District 9, and Avengers 2. Now, they've ranged from basically big-powered suits to giant, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60-foot-tall robots going head-to-head. And it's just been one of those things that we can't get enough of, particularly in military science fiction, also, obviously, Saturday morning cartoons, and Japanese anime. And the Japanese, in particular, have been very big on this in a number of their franchises and things like that. So, but anyway, this is also might be a case where science fiction is impacting science and impacting the real world. I've always like said before about the cell phone kind of being inspired by the tricorder, which a lot of people that worked with the early cell phones will tell you. In this case, there are two engineering teams, one from the U.S. and one from Japan, that are preparing for a giant robot fight challenge. You've probably seen it online. You've seen it on CNN. The U.S. team is developing Megabot, and the Japanese team is their robot's name is Karatas. And it's been on. There's YouTube videos. There's websites. You can see all about it. These are like kind of like the very beginning of a robot fighting league. And there's actually some people in the I think it's the Financial Times or Wall Street Journal that have suggested that robot fighting leagues might actually be a reality, similar to what you see in the movie Real Steel, that we could be a decade or two from something like that. And in a lot of ways, I mean, I could see it happening because you've just seen sports generally move away from the most violent stuff. Boxing is kind of losing its popularity. Football is basically becoming flag football in a lot of ways with all the new rules. And, well, there's still UFC, so, you know, we got something. But in some ways, you might see kind of you know, a move towards, you know, kind of getting our violence out in a way that won't permanently damage people's brains. And, you know, I welcome it. I love giant fighting robots since I was a kid. I watched Transformers all the time. I also watched the cartoon Battletech. And, you know, of course, all the movies I listed before, I loved all of those. And I have my own reasons for liking this thing, but I think the reason that I think that a lot of people kind of gravitate towards it is one, it kind of reminds us of knights in shining armor, kind of the romantic concept of combat, of noble heroes going head to head in some sort of melee combat, or maybe there's some use of projectile weapons, but it's much more personal rather than, you know, modern warfare, which is large armies, you know, fighting outside of visual range, you know, using drones in a lot of cases. You know, it's a very, I mean, it takes kind of the romanticism of warfare and kind of the personal, you know, nature of warfare out. And you really never get to see an enemy, you know, look into the eyes of the enemy, which it isn't just kind of a, you know, looking your enemy in the eyes. It isn't just like a poetic line. It's an important moral concept, which I'll get to later because it kind of matters with this. But anyway, in science fiction, you usually deal with energy projectile weapons. That's kind of the way we go. Fantasy loves sword and shield. There's tons of sword and shield going on, Game of Thrones, and also, you know, Star Wars with lightsabers. You know, we basically just did a hybrid of sword fighting with energy weapons. So that's how Star Wars won out. It kind of brought in, and you see kind of the dramatic kind of climaxes of all the movies are basically lightsaber battles one-on-one. There are some greater battles taking place in the background, but you know, a lot of the climaxes take place. It's a very personal, you know, very direct you know, one-on-one single combat, which, I mean, we just have an attachment to it, you know, culturally, historically. It feels like it needs to be personal. It needs to be direct, you know, this kind of, you know, industrial age warfare, you know, we find sick and disgusting. You know, all the movies we've made about it, you know, kind of take it away and kind of say, well, warfare is now pointless because it's now basically in the military-industrial complex. You know, who can make the better bomb? who can make the better drone in those cases. So the idea of the battle mech, which combines, you know, futuristic technology, you know, the idea of drones, the idea of robotics, but also kind of returning to that sort of romantic one-on-one style where you have a small number of very large weapons going at each other. So it's and they have to get within a certain, you know, there's probably still kind of a beyond visual range element to it, but what you could see and what you see in the books and what you see in the movies that have mechs, it isn't that way. It's more close in. Actually, a lot of these mechs, like in Pacific Rim, Voltron, Real Steel, BattleTech, they also have melee weapons like axes. They have some of them have swords, shields. You know, you have like those classic knights. So it's kind of something we just can't get away from. And I think writers and people in Hollywood know that you really aren't going to get people's blood flowing, you know, by showing a screen, you know, like that night vision screen of a stealth bomber, you know, dropping a weapon on a bridge somewhere and the explosion, and then it just, you know, flies home because it was 30,000 feet in the air. So I wanted to take on a special question here. Now, I mean, I could talk about how cool I think robots are and talk about this Megabot versus Karatus battle. We can do that for a while, but I think I wanted to take on kind of a direct question here. Could we actually see battle mechs in particular in warfare? They could be replacing all human soldiers. They could be replacing manned aircraft, vehicles, autonomous drones, you know, things of that. They could be replacing the tank. They could be manned. They could be unmanned. So I'm kind of just saying in general, not a particular type of system, but could we see walking battle mechs in the future? Is it even possible, or is it just something that it's kind of like a romantic sci-fi vision of future combat somehow still having some of that heroic and close and personal innate element to it? So this is kind of a world building thing, and I'm bringing some of my outside knowledge to bear here on military history, on engineering. I'm not an engineer, but I know a little bit about engineering. I've seen a ton of military documentaries, weaponology, future weapons, wings, sea wings, all the documentaries on World War II. So that officially makes me an expert. I think I should get a degree for all the TV I've watched. In addition to that, I did actually do some digging on my own on robotics and on some of the state of the technology and what kind of challenges we face to make a battle mech practical. So this is what I found. Now, the first idea is like when you're creating any kind of fictional weapon system, and this is what military sci-fi largely, you know, hangs its hat on. They kind of love creating new weapons in general that are, you know, they're just cool. I mean, there's not really a better, more poetic way to say it. They're just trying to make cool weapons or cool combat situations, cool battles, heroes. They kind of, you know, they really push your suspension of disbelief with some of the scenarios, or, you know, aliens. But if we're doing that, then yes, of course, you can just make a battle mech. You don't need to make it realistic or practical. You can just say, they use battle mechs now because I said so. Now, on the other side, you can actually try to create a at least a balanced conflict with your futuristic weapons. And those are the kind of military sci-fi I prefer, where obviously the author or the writer has put a lot more thought into the balance, to the nature of future combat, and hasn't just tried to make a cool weapon and try to fit it into his story by whichever way possible. I'm going to go the way of a little bit more of the hyper-technical and plausible, just to kind of test the limits here, because if I just, you know, if you're just writing a book, it's like, well, I want battle mechs. I mean, you can just do it. There's no one stopping you. So the first question, if we're trying to make a realistic weapon system, is for any weapon system, if we're trying to go realistic, is what is its mission? What is it intended to destroy? How is it supposed to impact the battlefield? Now, this is what procurement offices and the Defense Department does all the time. They don't just go to Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and Lockheed and basically say, we want a really, really cool fighter that might be stealth. No, they they show up with a list of requirements or a list of things they want in their weapon. And they said, here, you go build a prototype. You go build a prototype and we'll pick the winner, the one we prefer, the one we want. And it needs to fulfill the following missions. So that's, I mean, that's where they start. This is where all weapon systems start. You don't just, it's not just kind of, you know, let's put this together and see what it does. They have a mission in mind and they have an objective and also how it's going to be used before they start building it. Another consideration is the cost-benefit analysis of a weapon system. If you've watched, I think it's Nazi Mega Weapons. It was on Netflix. I think it might have been taken off. But it showed some of the super weapons that Hitler and the Nazis built in the World War II that ended up, they were amazing machines and amazing weapons, but they ended up not having much of an impact on the war. And the reason was simple. They were extremely expensive, and they're extremely difficult to maintain. And so you could only build a couple of them. And you can only, you know, if you only have four or five, you can only put them in four or five places. And he was fighting a two-front war. He needed something more than, you know, that could end up with five or six. He needed hundreds of whatever weapon they came up with. And to that, part of the cost side, it's not just the price tag of building it. It's the training that goes into the personnel that are going to use it and maintain it. There's the maintenance factor, how well it's going to hold up, what kind of work needs to be done while it's in the field, you know, how much work, how hard or easy it is to repair and keep the weapon system running. And then another element of cost is how much ammunition does it use? How much ammunition does it need to carry? Fuel, does it burn up a ton of fuel, or is it, you know, what type of fuel does it carry? So that all goes into cost. And then benefit, of course, is how good is it in the battlefield? And back to the mega weapons thing, some of the examples of this are in the show, but also more importantly, the big one is tanks. Most documentaries and things you'll see, they'll say that the Germans had great tanks, at least in the last 3 or 4 years of the war, which is true. Pound for pound, the most powerful tank was the King Tiger, or the Tiger. And it was about 60 to 65 tons, covered in armor, had a huge gun on top, very difficult to kill, had long range. An M4 Sherman had no chance. Basically, American tankers would just run and hide. Or, I mean, the other way is you basically get behind it and knock out its engine, which you got to hope it doesn't see you the whole time. So really, that was the best tank, probably pound for pound. But it didn't make a difference because it was extremely difficult to build, all the materials that went into building it. It consumed fuel at an insane amount. It was not easy to maintain. And you ended up only being able to put a few hundred in the field. I don't know how many were built in the end, but it wasn't that many. So he loses the war, Germany loses the war, even though they have probably the best tank. On the other side, you have the Russian T-34 tank. This is a lighter, easy to build, easy to throw together, very simple tank. It's quick. It doesn't have that much armor, but it's sloped armor, which was a very innovative thing and ended up being the breakthrough that gave it an edge. The T-34 was arguably the most important tank of the war because it could kill most German tanks and it was easy to build. So they put out hundreds, thousands of them, easily thousands of them. And the people to build them and to maintain them was easy. It was incredibly easy because they were so simple. And anyone could run them. Anyone could operate. They were basic because they were dealing with an army that was mostly illiterate. They didn't Russian soldiers. They were taking them off the farms. They were taking them out of factories. Many of them were 17 or 18. They barely knew to read. These weren't engineers. These weren't this is not what Americans put in tanks today. The soldiers we put out there are well trained, literate, educated, and a lot of them end up becoming engineers. This is not what Russia did in World War II. So they basically needed to idiot proof the tank, and they did. The T-34 killed and knocked out tons and tons of German tanks, including some King Tigers. And that ended up being one of the major factors on the Eastern Front. Even though the T-34 one-on-one probably can't beat a King Tiger, doesn't matter. That's not how battles are decided, and that's not how wars are decided. Another example would be the Bismarck, the giant German battleship. So giant, so expensive, so nasty that I think he only built two of that class of battleship, and they ended up having absolutely no real relevance to the war. You combine that with the the destroyer escorts and the destroyers that the U.S. built to protect the shipping from the U.S. to Great Britain, the Liberty cargo ships, which we could build because they were all standardized and modular in nature, so we basically mass-produced these cargo ships. We built them faster than the U-boats could sink them. Another example, some of the super cannons the Germans built, which had incredible range and incredible power, but again, they could only build a couple of them and didn't make a difference. The V-2 rocket, terrifying weapon, didn't make a difference. It's really amazing that the best, you know, tanks, you know, from a purely objective standpoint, were the best weapon systems. Many of them were German, but it didn't matter because the effectiveness. So, all right. So that's cost benefit analysis. That's the other part. There's the mission, the cost benefit analysis. So, what is a battle mech going to do? Well, for a battle mech, we kind of envision it in the books, in the movies, in the TV shows, the cartoons, the board games. It becomes the new frontline weapon system. It replaces the tank. It replaces mechanized infantry. It replaces, you know, everything else. It's a land weapon. That's usually how we vision it. In some cases, it can fly, kind of like a helicopter. It's not a high-speed fighter, but it is something that can hover. And so let's just say that's what it is. It's there to replace the tank. It's there to replace the attack helicopter, the Apache. It is there to replace a large number of the missions that we normally rely on a tank for. So multiple mission. And then the other possibilities that it could carve out its own new niche that no existing weapon system can do. And I think a battle mech of the future, that's one way it might be built, because there are things that a tank cannot do. There are things that none of our weapon systems cannot do. And one of them, for example, is, say, fight a battle on a planet without oxygen. You could maybe pressurize a tank, but our weapon systems are designed for Earth's gravity, Earth's atmosphere, oxygen level, the terrain, everything. A battle mech, in theory, could be designed to deal with any terrain, any atmosphere, any planet, any gravity. That would be the idea. The concept behind the battle mech is that it can be used in a multiple number of areas that a tank cannot. Because tanks are, you know, you could pressurize a tank, you could do some of those things, but in the end, it's still limited. So, next up. So, to replace the tank, let's just, I'll just go real quick. This is how you would just replace the tank, if that's all we wanted to start off with. The battle tank right now is currently the main front line battle weapon. Or, you know, armored vehicle, whatever. Basically, it's an armored vehicle. It can either be, you know, the M1 Abrams. It can be the Stryker vehicle. And these basically came in the 20th century and replaced the kind of rifleman-infantry-cavalry combination. And the reason was a tank could carry more firepower. It was equally or more mobile than infantry or cavalry at the time. And it was much more survivable thanks to its armor. And as time went on, the effectiveness that these weapons had relative to the cost of building one made it more than worth it, the CB analysis. And so that's why we use them. Since the Cold War, the mechanized infantry, like, for example, the Stryker vehicle, the M2 Bradley, and some of the newer weapons that the Army has been discussing, they could conceivably do a lot of what, you know, what our M1 Abrams does now. You also have the Apache helicopter, which has just been a game changer for the last few years in Afghanistan and Iraq. But the tank is still, it may not have the primacy it used to, but it's still one of the main battle systems. Like I said, firepower, it has a tank killer on top, 120mm or 105mm. Most tanks have something in that range. It can kill or disable just about any vehicle at a very, very long range. Infantry can carry javelin rocket launchers. Helicopters have Hellfires, so this isn't exactly, it's not a huge advantage, but then again, a tank can also carry a 50 cal, a grenade launcher, any number of things you put on top of it. It can travel to 20, 30 miles per hour over a fair number of amounts of terrains. It has armor, so most small arms won't do anything to it. Grenades won't do anything to it. There are certain anti-tank weapons which will damage it, but won't knock it out. And that's why we use it. It's relatively cheap compared to the Apache helicopter. It's probably more expensive than a Stryker or a Bradley vehicle. But so that's where it fits, and that's why the tank is. So a mech would have to do all those things: have the firepower, mobility, and survivability of a main battle tank. It'd have to match it. It'd have to surpass it, actually, completely surpass it in those ways. What would be the maybe the biggest obstacles? Well, number one would obviously be cost. Building a battle mech using current technology or maybe something in the near future would be insanely expensive. It would be bigger, need more propulsion, a bigger engine. It would have a lot of moving parts, and it would require a whole new host of skills for the personnel that are using it. It would be far more expensive than a tank, probably the same cost as an F-22 fighter. And in the end, I don't really think it could match a tank in those three important categories of firepower, mobility, and survivability. So it's not mobile enough. There's no real reason to think a battle mech, a walking mech, would be faster than a tank. Its firepower, it could maybe carry more firepower if it had enough power, propulsion. But really, I don't know if that's going to be the factor. And in terms of survivability, a mech would be a big target. And all you would really need to do is knock out one of its knees and make it fall on its ass. And it's basically out of the game. So for all those reasons, a mech in the near future is just not going to happen. It just doesn't make any sense. It carries no real advantage over what we use today. And we're not going to bother. No one's going to bother building such a thing. Now, a lot of you out there, nerds, the big military nerds and geeks, are telling me, well, no shit, Wes. I didn't need to tune into this podcast to know mechs aren't practical today. So, fine. Let's say we're in the future. Do we think we'll ever see them? What would it take for a battle mech to become practical? And I put some thought into this. And like I said, the three categories, firepower, mobility, survivability, needs to be way better than a tank in those three areas. Well, to do that, you need power. Propulsion. That's it. If you can have a propulsion system that could produce, you know, 4x, 5x, 6x what a tank engine can produce, that can maybe push the battle mech idea further into practical use. Because one, with more propulsion, your mech can carry more weapons and ammo, and that way have more firepower than a tank. It could be more mobile. It would move faster. Three, the propulsion would allow designers to put more armor on it to make it a little bit more survivable to attacks. Still has a problem with the knees and vulnerable areas and being a big target, but at least that's a starting point. You can maybe move it into the sum, but you would need a propulsion system that's very powerful, very efficient, and won't blow up, you know, if somebody shoots at it the wrong way. So that's where it would start. But let's say you do have a propulsion system, a fusion, you know, nuclear reactor, whatever, you know, whatever fictional energy source you put in there, it can really boost it. Well, that means you need a weapon system that, let's tackle the hard one first. You need a battle mech that can take a hit, that whether it's a tank, infantry, whatever other people can carry and strike it with, it needs to be able to withstand the hit. Whether it survives, it can either stay upright, or if you knock it over, it can get back up quickly. So that means the legs and the arms and the whole body needs to be agile. It needs to be capable of dealing with the blows of explosions and things like that. And the knees have to be able to stand up. So that means a lot of armor, or a brand new armor that is very, very strong. If this becomes the case, then if you get all that, then you're halfway there, because then you have survivability. Mobility, I don't think it's more than just straightaway speed. I think, like I said before, you want it to do more than what a tank can do. And for a mech that has arms and legs, it can climb. Tanks can't climb. You can design a mech that, just like what you see in the Transformers movies or in, you know, certain other movies, where they either have jump jets and can levitate, hover, and fly a little bit, or they can just climb. They have arms, they can just lift themselves, they can possibly swim. They'd have to be airtight, pressurized, watertight. And that means they can traverse a greater number of obstacles and terrain and fight in more areas than a tank can. That would give it a serious edge. But to do all that, it'd have to be agile. It would have to be capable of climbing, capable of maintaining balance, and doing all these things with a little trouble. And the weapons, obviously, is a no-brainer. If you have a giant mech, it has to carry more weapons than a tank. What does that all mean? Well, unless a propulsion system comes out, battle mechs aren't worth thinking about. Theoretically, if it does, you would still need to design an incredible war machine that would be easy to maintain, you can't, something this big and this important, this powerful, you can't have it breaking down easily, and you can't have them out of the game for too long, and they need to be able to stay in the fight and take hits. It's hard for me to see, because a battle mech would be such a huge target for anyone, any weapon, it's hard, unless, I mean, you would really need not only a new propulsion system, you'd need a new type of armor that was, its weight wouldn't be too much of a penalty. And I mean, those are two big innovations. And you also have to have a change in the theories of warfare. I mean, we don't really fight, we don't fight a lot of battles on vast battlefields with big super weapons. Recently, we've done mostly asymmetric warfare. Our enemies don't line up in the field or dig trenches. They hide. And we don't really have a rival at this point. America doesn't. But if we did, conceivably, even then, with the presence of nuclear weapons, even the buildup of conventional weapons into a conventional war in the future is still unlikely. Unless you can somehow take nuclear weapons out of the game. And missile defense shield, and I guess it's possible. I'm kind of getting out of what the subject here was. But I guess what I'm saying is, I just don't see, with all the technological challenges and the practical challenges of it, I don't think we're going to see fighting mechs in my lifetime. It's just too far off, and just too many hurdles need to be overcome, and I just don't see that happening, you know, in this century. But that's just this guy's opinion. Now, I mentioned before that, you know, facing your enemy, you know, looking your enemy in the eye, that kind of poetic line that has kind of been used in various ways in different movies. And we have it in movies, more movies all the time, where the enemies have this moment where they're looking at each other right in the eye. And they're actually, even though they're trying to kill each other, they're sharing a moment. There's a respect, there's an honor sometimes, there's a thing where they both, you know, they kind of pity each other. There's no longer that hatred, there's no longer that, you know, you've invaded my country, how dare you. The politics disappears, and it comes down to just two people both being forced to do something that is ugly, to kill. And to kill is not easy. At least, you know, you do it because you're trained, you do it out of necessity, but it often leaves psychological scars. And in general, the studies have shown that a lot of soldiers have a hard time killing when they're first introduced into battle. They very often fire over the heads of the enemy intentionally, I'm trying to think if it was the Army or the Marines. They had to introduce new methods of training to kind of get that out, because they noticed that new conscripts in Vietnam would almost always shoot over the heads of the enemy. It would take a while before they would actually aim to kill the enemy, and it's not that they didn't want to, you know, it's not that they wanted to die. It was just taking a life for somebody who's never done it before, regardless of your training and regardless of what kind of person you are, for most people, it's very difficult. So, but of course, with modern warfare, we bomb people from 30,000 feet. We send cruise missiles from ships that are in the Gulf somewhere. The people pulling the trigger and the people pressing the button, they see it on a TV screen, and it's a puff of, you know, light. It's like a flash of light and then a puff of smoke. And then they see if the building's been blown up, or the tank, or the bridge, or whatever they were hitting. That's what they see. That's what a lot of what we see back home. We don't really, since we don't fight wars on American soil, we fight wars abroad. And also our allies do as well. Europe has not fought a war on its own soil for 50, 60 years. Russia, China really have not. Most conflict takes place somewhere else. So a lot of us, and you can fight wars without using everyone. We have an army, we have a country of about 320 million people, and our overall military service is probably somewhere around 1 to 2 million of them, which means less than 1% of our population has to actually be involved in the military operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, wherever. That's unusual. You know, throughout human history, a lot of times a bigger piece of the population had to fight. They often had to fight on their own land for their own lives. They had many enemies. They did not have much deterrence other than city walls. And so there's a different feeling that a lot of us are not touched by war. And the automation of war has really changed that as well. And so you no longer have, in addition to technology, missiles, long-range weapons that push armies farther apart to the point where they may not even see each other, to look each other eye to eye. We may not have those moments anymore. Hand-to-hand combat. It does happen in asymmetric warfare because they force us to get in dirty with them and get into these things at close range because they have found ways to evade our big systems. But that's that type of enemy. That's an asymmetric enemy. You can't necessarily always fight that way, and that's not always the preferred way. But we still fight them with automated weapons. We do have a lot of people coming home with injuries that have done horrible things, that have had to kill people up close. But the overall sense of it is that we're able to do a lot of things, our soldiers, without ever actually seeing what happens. So if we do get battle mechs, giant fighting robots, or medium-sized fighting robots, and the question becomes, will they be operated by pilots or operators, which is the romantic version of combat, one-on-one, except instead of one-on-one, hand-to-hand, it's one-on-one, my mech versus your mech. That's one way. It's more likely they'll be unmanned. They'll be drones, because we are moving towards that, and also we see the wisdom of fighting battles where we don't actually lose any soldiers. We send in the drones. We send in all these things so that we don't have to fight and we don't have to spill any blood. Just consider a moment a futuristic situation where major wars between the great powers are fought by giant automated mechs. Your only hope is that the battlefields are far away from where you live, from cities, from places of civilization. If that's the case, then maybe that's the preferred way to go, and warfare becomes more of comes with all these rules, similar to what you had in the 18th and 17th centuries, where armies lined up, faced each other in a field, and took turns shooting at each other. That was, the American colonists in the Revolutionary War decided that was ridiculous, and since then we've kind of, it took a while, but we finally abandoned that stupid bloodletting. But we might go back to something like that, where we put a bunch of battle mechs out there in a field somewhere and have them go head-to-head with their mechs, and that's the end of it. And we fight wars using robots and agree that to avoid bloodshed and avoid the mass destruction of what our weapons can do, our drones, our fighters, our nuclear weapons, we agree to have these gentlemanly duels where mechs go head-to-head and may the best mech win, or the best mech army win. It's a nice thought. It's not very realistic, but it's a nice thought. Another possibility is that these things is that we move away from the laws of war and international law, and these things basically become terrors that go into foreign countries, and after we've defeated the enemy, these mechs are used as deterrents, similar to nuclear weapons, where they will go into cities, they will go into areas where people are, and have the capability to just unleash all sorts of violence. They can go to planets. And the people at home may not really object because they don't see it. They don't lose any soldiers. Yeah, it's expensive, but I mean, a lot of times we don't really, if the cost is manageable, that's not really the part that ends wars. It's usually the bloodshed. It's the coffins that come home with flags draped over the top. It's the servicemen that return home with PTSD or horrific injuries, scars that are difficult to live with, that make them dependent on their families or the VA, God forbid. And that's a lot of times what pressures people to stop. And Vietnam was a popular war. For example, Vietnam was a popular war until, I believe, it was the Tet Offensive, and the body count went way up, and some of the images from the cameramen's, the reporters, came home, and they realized how horrible it was, and that's when the American public started to turn away from it. Well, if you're not putting any of your soldiers in jeopardy, you're just losing machinery. You know, who the hell cares? And that's the fear I have, is that automating warfare, whether it's automated drones or battle mechs or anything like this, and that's the problem, that the moral component is removed. And Robert E. Lee had a great line. He said, it's good that warfare is terrible, or else we should grow fond of it. It should be terrible. It destroys a civilization. That's really all it does. And it's involved with, you know. So the point is, it should be terrible. That's it. Battle mechs, automated drones, whatever, makes it unterrible. And we've seen both kind of battle mechs. In BattleTech, Pacific Rim, Voltron, a few of these others, the battle mechs are operated and piloted. So you get kind of you get the human component to war and to combat, and you get to play into the soldier's mindset. And you also have unmanned mechs, like in Falling Skies or The Avengers 2, when Ultron's army are basically they're all automated. They're all him, extensions of him, but they're basically automated. And then Transformers, where the robots are aliens, not human. So you've seen two different kinds, and they've been able to spin two different stories, but usually the automated weapons are the bad guys. The Falling Skies, they're the mechs that belong to the alien invaders, the Eshvili, I think they're called. Avengers 2, it's Ultron. Actually, that's exactly what Tony Stark is trying to build in Avengers 2, an automated defense force, a city wall of non-human soldiers. That's twisted into a mistake, and it becomes the enemy. It's kind of like what I'm saying here. The moral dimension of war cannot be taken away. And that's kind of the lesson of Avengers 2. If there is a lesson to Avengers 2, for the most part, it's basically explosions and fighting and Scarlett Johansson. But if there was a point to Avengers 2, the lesson would be the dangers of technology, advanced technology in warfare. And Iron Man's suit is an example of that, because in the first movie, I mean, he says he wants to build something that's defensive, but Iron Man is not defensive. The Iron Man suit has weapons and is capable of massive destruction. He just happens to use it for non-bloodshed ends. And so his idea that I'm going to build something that protects people instead of kills people is nonsensical. The only reason it doesn't kill people is because he chooses not to use it to kill people. It can very well kill a lot of people. But there's a man inside. That's the difference. He's inside of it making the call. There's a human inside. Now, in the first movie, Jeff Bridges gets inside and is okay with killing people. In the second one, Mickey Rourke gets inside and he's willing to kill people. So the idea that Iron Man or these suits, whether they're manned or unmanned, is the answer is ridiculous. And it morally and also just from a strategic standpoint doesn't make a difference. And so that's kind of why I didn't like the second movie. And in a way, the Iron Man idea in general, to me, misses that. So it's just a straight action movie, and Robert Downey Jr. is awesome. So great movies, but don't teach you about warfare. Yeah, I guess the difference between mechs and powered suits. I kind of said giant mechs, like giant robots, like the size of Optimus Prime in the Transformers movies, or the BattleTech mechs, I think, were several stories tall, because they need to be that tall to house the propulsion system, house all the extra weapons, and house all the armor. So the assumption being that some of them are going to be very large, some of them might be mid-size, and some of them might just be what are called powered suits. This is a really common This is a common type of miniature mechanized weapon, the powered suit. It's been prevalent since the Lensman series by E.E. Doc Smith. That was almost a century ago. And, of course, Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers. It presents kind of an interesting advantage over giant mechs because, one, you don't need the new propulsion system. You don't need the armor. It's not as big of a target. You lose a lot of capability in terms of firepower because it's a soldier that has enhanced strength and speed because of the mechanisms in the arms and legs, but it's not really the same as a tank, and it's not really as mobile as a tank because you still need a man inside there moving. And guys and girls, women too, because we now have women in combat role, they can get tired. Now, the things that are in the works with companies such as Cyberdyne, I just found out there is a company called Cyberdyne in Japan working on powered legs and powered arms, powered suits. So you want Skynet? That's how you get Skynet. But anyway, it does present some advantages. It does restore some of the kind of from an artistic standpoint, it restores some of the romanticism of warfare when the robots are actually have men inside of them. The robots are not big. They can move around in urban settings, and they can hide. Battle mechs are easy targets. Powered suits would probably make the soldier bigger by a couple feet, maybe more, but they wouldn't be massive. And so that's another interesting thing where it's used in some, where you could also use combinations of in a future story. I haven't seen this yet, but I'm willing to bet there's stories out there where there are military sci-fi series where there's giant battle mechs and then there's small powered suits. And so it's kind of like the infantry and the armor, the infantry and the tank or whatever. I think that's more likely. I think we're almost there. I think the DoD and a number of companies are very close to creating what are powered suits. I think that is the future. And we also have quadruped. We have pack animals, robotic pack animals that I've seen the video footage on YouTube. I'll try to get the link here on this site. That you can kick this quadruped, this four-legged robot, and it will not fall down. It adjusts. You can kick it, push it, whatever. It learns how to adjust its legging, adjust its balance using math, I guess. And that's, I think, where we're going. Powered suits, robotic donkeys and camels, and nuclear weapons. I think that's our foreseeable future in warfare. I love battle mechs, and I love fighting robots, but I know they're not realistic. But for considerations for your book, all right, realistically, no. But if you wanted to make one for a novel or a story or whatever, here are some considerations to maybe make it maybe more balanced or make it make a little bit of sense. All right, like I said, if you're going to have giant battle mechs, they need to have a lot of power. They need to be fast, agile, and capable of just going over any terrain, any planet, any atmosphere, any gravity, any kind of, it has to deal with everything, because that's the only way. That's really the only way you can realistically say it's superior to a tank. Otherwise, they just use tanks and infantry or powered suits. I would pair them with powered suits. I think that makes the most sense. I think military tends to do things in gradations and in various hierarchies. So you might have a small, medium, large situation, small powered suits, medium-sized mechs, and then the big boys. Energy weapons probably are the way to go. If you put an ammunition-based weapon on a mech, then it has to carry a ton of ammunition. And then if that ammunition's explosive, then, well, you've basically made your mech extremely vulnerable. You don't have to make them 100 tons. There are certain Battletech mechs that are 100 tons. Consider this. If it is 100 tons, it's going to sink into the ground, basically, unless it has giant feet. The only reason tanks don't sink into the ground, and sometimes they do, is that the weight is distributed over the tracks. So that's why wheeled vehicles can't be that heavy, because only a small part of the wheel touches the ground. A track spreads the weight out. Now, if you're a tank is about 60, the M1 Abrams is about 65 tons. If you make your battle mech 100 tons and it has legs, those legs, the feet have to be basically, have to have more, cover more area than the tracks of a tank. Probably not that hard. But if you make them any heavier than that, then they'll just sink. And then actually in a lot of these scenarios where they're in the mud or they're on a planet with a lot of gravity, it's not that they don't have the strength to stand up and move around in the heavy gravity, but they might just sink into the ground. And also, it just doesn't make sense that as we develop new super materials, smart materials, and new kind of alloys, that you would need 100 tons of armor. If anything, you would probably want to have less armor, less weight to make it more agile. Like I said, I think the real advantage of robots is their mobility. And they don't get tired, and in the future, possibly they won't run on any kind of fuel. They'll have a renewable fuel source. Let's see. Missiles, a very cool thing. A lot of people use them. Not very likely, because there are computers and there are deterrent systems now that can knock missiles out of the sky. Warships have them already. We were pretty close to having a missile defense shield over the entire United States when it comes to ICBMs or intermediate ballistic missiles. There's at a medium to short range, there are just progress being made in countermeasures that if you have a missile or some sort of projectile chemical-based weapon that travels at a certain speed, there's possibly a computer that can calculate where it's going to be and shoot off a countermeasure to knock it out. The only way around that, I think, would be a weapon that is extremely fast, like the speed of light, like a laser. But it's really, other than that, there's really nothing wrong with using a missile. I mean, you just have to find a way through the countermeasures. I've seen Battletech uses kind of make-believe particle projection cannons and autocannons. Autocannon doesn't really make any sense. It's basically a shotgun, but if you have really, really strong armor, the way we kill tanks today is not with shotguns or weapons that are explosive. Explosive weapons don't do anything to tanks. You need penetration weapons. That's how tanks are killed. And that's why, even though, for example, if you look at a round that a tank fires, it's 120 millimeters in diameter, but the actual projectile that goes into the enemy tank is not 120 millimeters. It's much smaller. It's inside that case. It's called a sabot round. And that's the other thing with these kind of, you can create all these weapons that create massive explosions and put off a lot of heat, but if you have the armor that can withstand the heat and the blast, you haven't done anything. So the current warfare is about penetration. It's about getting through the armor. And even in air forces, we have stealth technology, which is a way of getting through their air defenses. We no longer do mass, we don't do mass saturation bombing anymore. We do interdiction bombing. We do smart bombs. We try to hit targets. We don't just carpet bomb places anymore because there's not really much point to it. So I think future would probably still move in that trend because we have the ability to protect ourselves from explosions. We might even one day have the ability to protect against nuclear blasts. Sure, there'll still be damage and heat and everything, but we might have the means to protect cities from a nuclear blast. It's not out of the realm of possibility. The thing that kills is the blast itself. But the blast usually does not have the huge radius. The heat and the shockwave have the radius. And if you have a target, a ship, a battle mech, or even a small installation, you can build it to withstand heat and make it withstand certain types of force. We have bunkers that do this. NORAD is, designed to withstand. And we might reach a point with materials where you don't need to go underground to protect yourself from a nuclear blast. We might be able to build military installations that can withstand a nuclear blast. It's not out of the realm of possibility. There's already ways of protecting yourself from a nuclear blast. It's just extremely expensive, heavy, and just not practical to build cities out of it. And let's see, what else? Melee. It's fun, like giving robots swords and axes, like Optimus Prime and his sword, I think Megatron had some sort of whip, or Morningstar, or a mace, or whatever. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It's not something that would come up in modern warfare when you have all these other weapons, but it makes for great scenes in movies, for Michael Bay movies, and it makes for cool little things, like I said, Star Wars uses lightsabers to maintain the idea of using swords. Certain movies have duels where they intentionally put aside their modern blaster weapons or laser cannons or guns or whatever, and they just fight hand to hand or with swords because it's considered more gentle and it's just more fun. To see for us. I mean, watching two people shoot at each other from a distance and one gets hit. We like those. We like gun battles, but there's something about when it's one on one, you can't really do that. When it's army versus army or a squad versus a squad or Rambo, going through and fighting a large number of people, that's kind of the way you can do it because none of the people he's killing are really characters. They're bodies. The time when it comes time for Rambo to kill the bad guy, it's usually much more personal and upfront, and it's head to head. Not always, but that's usually how it comes down to. It's not going to happen on a field, 50 yards apart. Okay, well, I think I've beaten that to death. I think in terms of the future, I think Pacific Rim is getting a sequel when it comes to battle mech movies. The first movie was pretty eh. I know some people love Pacific Rim. The idea of kaiju versus robot is kind of a cool little combination of monsters and robots, and I just thought the whole movie was a little silly, especially when they pull out the sword at the end of the movie and you're just left asking yourself, why didn't they just use that to begin with? I think there's probably another Transformers movie coming, unfortunately, but those movies are getting, well, I mean, they're already kind of lowbrow. They were a lot of fun to watch. I loved them because, like I said, I love fighting robots, and I used to watch Transformers, and so I have kind of a connection to Optimus Prime and these things. But the movies are getting weirder and dumber and just really mind-numbing. It's 2.5 hours of bay explosions, and it's really just starting to wear out. So I think there's another one coming. I don't know that for sure. I'm assuming, you know, they'll try because the first few movies were big money makers. I think the fourth one bombed, but that still won't stop them. Well, there's a lot of Japanese anime, Gundam, Evangelion, Knights of Sidonia. There's a whole bunch that I'm not even aware of. So if you're into mechs and you love anime, you'll have no trouble finding battle mechs in those. They usually use all sorts of tricks and fictional technologies to build the kind of conflict they want. So I don't really get into those as much, but it's still fun to watch. I mean, some of that stuff's pretty fun to watch. I think District 9 was supposed to get a sequel, but I don't think it is. Falling Skies is a TV show that is, it's okay. There's probably another Avengers movie coming, and if there's another Iron Man movie, you'll it's an easy, safe bet. There'll be robots in it. So that's where we are. That's where, if you want battle mechs, that's everything I know about these things, everything I've learned in terms of military and everything else. So do with it what you will. If you're a writer, author, or whatever, if you are a fan of battle mechs, this is my take on these things. Do with it what you will. You may think I'm a complete idiot, don't know what I'm talking about, or that I'm, or, you know, completely agree with me, whatever. Anyway, I'm going to sign off there. And on the next episode, I will speak with the Grand Master of the Illuminati. We will discuss their plans for world domination and what you'll have to look forward to in the New World Order. It should be a good show.